Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much does a journalist need to know in order to report the truth? We expect that reporters will use a combination of observation and interviewing in order to bring us important stories. But as my guest today will tell us, journalists assigned to cover subjects they don't deeply and thoroughly understand may recount facts with precise accuracy and still lead readers, viewers, or listeners to incorrect conclusions. Thomas E. Patterson is Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at Harvard Kennedy School's Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. His new book is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Thomas, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
You call journalists our chief sense makers. What does that mean exactly?
Well, we depend on journalists to really get a sense of what the world out there is like. I mean, politics for most of us is secondhand. We observe the things that are happening in our communities and our neighborhoods, but beyond that, we really depend on journalists to tell us what's happening. And the theme of the book is that much of what they tell us is not quite accurate. Sometimes it's misleading, and in general, we need journalists to do a better job of helping us understand that outside world.
So essentially, a journalist whose subject knowledge is not as deep as any source's knowledge might be is really not in a position necessarily to ask the right questions?
Well, it's tricky. You know, if you think about journalists, they're different than members of other professions. You know, doctors are trained in medical science. Lawyers are trained in a body of law. Economists in economic theories. Journalists really are not trained in a body of knowledge. They're trained to do stories so that they learn how to gather the information, put it together in story form, disseminate it. But the subject matter, often for a journalist, will vary from day to day. And in those instances, they can be vulnerable to their sources. You know, it's interesting that, you know, if you went into your doctor's office and you knew more about medicine than your doctor, you wouldn't go back. But, you know, journalists are in that funny position where usually the person they're talking to, the source, knows more about the subject matter than they do. And that does set them up for manipulation, for spin. We see that most clearly in the area of politics. But, you know, it can happen, too, with experts. You know, experts are not always dispassioned in their judgments and the like. And journalists often are in the position of having to take what's being said by an interviewee at face value and work from there. And my argument is that that puts them at a disadvantage. And some of the things that we see happening in journalism are explained by that particular relationship with their sources.
And, of course, it could be that a source is not intending to mislead a journalist, but that source might be biased without realizing it.
Well, we all are to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, we all have the capacity to kind of look out at the world and see it the way we want to see it. So, you know, even if we're trying to play it straight, we're not always giving it straight. But, you know, but increasingly, you know, the world of information is a world of public relations and spin and the like. And I think it is, if not in kind, certainly in degree, it's a different situation today than it was 40 or 50 years ago. I think the communication at that point was less sophisticated, maybe more naive, more direct. But, you know, we live in a world of spin and misinformation, and journalists are caught up in it.
So, Thomas, is the definition of journalistic truth different somehow than truth in its purest form?
Well, you know, journalists, you know, will say that truth is is their holy grail, that that's what they're after. But, you know, that claim doesn't stand up to the facts. I mean, there have been lots of studies that have been done of, you know, journalists talking about trends, for example, on economic trends. Usually journalists are behind the curve, not ahead of the curve. Oftentimes the economy will move in the other direction, and it'll be weeks before journalists really come to a recognition that those things have changed. And, you know, so that this is a difficult task. I'm not trying to minimize the challenges that journalists face, but increasingly, as policy becomes more complex, as society gets more complex, journalists have to get on top of it. And the way to get on top of it is to have a deeper understanding of those issues and processes. You know, Jack Germond, this great reporter for the Baltimore Sun, covered probably a dozen presidential campaigns, did it well. And Germond said that, you know, when he was asked to cover policy, the best he could do was hum a few tunes. He really didn't understand policy that well, so that, you know, he was vulnerable to his sources. And increasingly, I think that's where most journalists are today.
And, of course, we expect our colleagues in journalism to issue a correction if they get someone's name wrong or a piece of data wrong in a story. But if they predict something or describe something as a trend and don't describe it quite accurately, you pretty much never see a correction published a month later to say, we didn't understand this fully.
Well, that's the advantage of time for the journalist. You know, most of these predictions, most of these projections are out there in the future, and you know, and so you kind of never catch up with them. You know, I cite in the book the example of what journalism was like in terms of predicting elections before there were election polls. Mm. And the history of that is a history of mishits. You know, consistently, you know, it was about a 50-50 thing. They get right about half the time, they get it wrong about half the time, which meant that, you know, they were projecting from pretty thin material. And of course, now that you have polls and in a presidential election campaign, you'll get about 200 in the last 2 months. So everybody's got a pretty good read on the on how an election is likely to come out. But, you know, if journalists are simply depending on their own resources, trying to make judgments from bits and pieces of information, there's likely to be wrong as not. But I think it's a deeper problem of a lack of knowledge on the part of journalists. It's the context in which a lot of the reporting takes place. You know, we had at our center at Harvard, Matt Storen, who had been the editor of the Boston Globe, came here right after he stepped down as the editor, and this was right after 9/11. And Matt wanted to look at how did journalists cover the terrorism developments and events prior to 9/11. And he looked at the 1993, the first bombing of the World Trade Centers, 1993. He looked at the bombing of the two SE embassies in Africa, 1998, the bombing of the U.S. coal in Yemen Harbor in 2000. And what he found was that journalists were pretty good about describing the event, what had happened, how many were injured or killed. But what they didn't do was to dig more deeply into the story. You know, what's this international terrorism all about? Where is it coming from? What are the political, the religious, the cultural aspects of this that are driving this? And is there a network? Are these groups related? There's virtually none of that. And then 9/11 happens, and journalists say are caught by surprise. They didn't connect the dots, and so when that happened, basically they discovered the perpetrators when the American public did, which was when George W. Bush stood in the well of the House of Representatives and identified the attack as originating with Al-Qaeda. We need better journalism than that if we're going to be trying to think hard about these issues that we face today.
One thing that's really troubling is that your sense is that this is not a particular concern within the journalism profession. There seem to be a lot of people who are content to say we are providing accurate information and not so worried about the overall context.
Well, no, I think there are some voices like that, but I do think there are changes in the direction that I'm talking about, and in some ways I'm arguing for an acceleration of those trends. You know, increasingly in a newsroom you'll find someone with economics training, you'll find someone with legal training, you'll find someone with training in the sciences. The science reporters increasingly have that kind of background. It's not widespread yet in journalism. Less than 5% of working journalists have an advanced degree in a subject area. But I think that trend is developing. I think Also, you see it in the way that journalists are increasingly making use of the Internet to try to get background information for their stories and try to get on top of stories as they're developing. I think we see this increasingly. But that's not quite enough, I don't think. I think they have to move more quickly in the newsroom to build that into their subject area expertise, into their capacity. But also, when you think about the Internet, a lot of that information is not very reliable. And it's one thing to, you know, write up a story and then go to the Internet and find something that you can drop in there as a little nugget that kind of embellishes the story. That's different than what I'm talking about. I'm talking about having a deep enough understanding about an issue that you know where the story should go and what dimensions of the story are not being told adequately. And for that, it's very difficult to kind of do these quick hits. In some ways, you've got to more deeply school yourself on the issues that you're covering.
Well, how much is that lack of deep subject knowledge on the part of individual reporters tied to economics? Because if one has a law degree or a medical degree, you'll make a lot more practicing law or medicine than being a journalist in almost every situation.
Oh, that's true. And you know, there are people who are public-minded, and I think one of the characteristics of almost every journalist is that they are public-minded, that they want to inform the public that they got into this business not because it's high-paying, because it's not a high-paying profession, but because, you know, they kind of see themselves as having a public responsibility. And you can pull those people into the newsroom. In fact, some of the people who really do journalism well, I think, are in that category. And then you get others like David Sanger or Tom Friedman of the New York Times that have basically gone to school on the subjects that they're reporting on. And, you know, they do deep reporting. They do it well. I mean, it's possible to do this. But, you know, anything like this, any kind of major transformation, any kind of reorientation of a profession, you don't do that overnight. It takes time. And so this is kind of a long-term vision for journalism, you know, whether there'll be adequate buy-in within journalism practice and in journalism schools to make it happen. That's always an open question. I'm somewhat optimistic, but guardedly, I think. But I see some developments within journalism that are heading in this direction, and it's an argument for doing it more and doing it more quickly.
You include an account here of a sort of funny story about a sign that was put up in the Pentagon press office during the Persian Gulf War that sort of acknowledged the reality of that gap in understanding between journalists and their subjects. Will you tell us that story?
Well, this was during the first war in the Persian Gulf. This is the Persian Gulf War. This is under President George H.W. Bush when they put the coalition together, when Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait and they were going to push him back into Iraq. And in the Pentagon press office, preparation was occurring, and then once the hostilities actually began, when reporters walked into the Pentagon press office, they were greeted by a sign that said, "Welcome, temporary war experts." you know, and it's kind of, it goes back to that point that you started our discussion with, and that's the point that, you know, journalists often are forced to rely on sources who know more about the subject area than they do, they've got to quickly get up to speed on these kinds of things. It's a very difficult task.
My guest is Thomas E. Patterson. He is Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at the Harvard Kennedy School's Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy. His new book is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas E. Patterson of the Harvard Kennedy School's Joan Shorenstein Center on Press, Politics, and Public Policy. His new book is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Thomas, I'd like to talk a little bit about your definition of knowledge-based journalism. Does that require a degree in the subject matter? Is it possible for reporters to be sort of autodidacts and learn on the job?
Well, I don't think it requires a degree. I do think, though, that journalists need to know how to use knowledge. I mean, I think that's a minimum. You know, one of the things, if you go through journalism school, you don't necessarily have to emerge with statistical literacy, but, you know, it's very difficult to be a reporter today without being able to know the numbers and read the numbers. It doesn't mean that you have to be able to do them, but you have to be able to understand them and interpret them in order to convey accurately to your audience what the numbers mean. And, you know, Jack Fuller, who won the Pulitzer Prize, he was the longtime editor and publisher at the Chicago Tribune, said he was aghast at the kind of the statistical literacy that exists among journalists. He said, you know, many of them simply don't know how to use the numbers, and yet they put them into their reports and often do so inaccurately, and anyone that would take them seriously or read the interpretation would be misled about what the development consists of. So I do think there are certain kind of minimal standards about the ability to use knowledge properly. And if you take substantive knowledge, there is a knowledge of how to use knowledge. It's not simply pulling something off the web, doing a quick read and think you have an understanding of it. You know, knowledge really kind of opens your mind to possibilities and gives you a deeper understanding of what's at work. And let me give you an example of that. You know, we've been hearing about the euro crisis now for some time, and oftentimes those stories seem to suggest that, you know, this is a contest between the frugal Germans and the spendthrift Greeks, or that this is a personal battle between Merkel and Sarkozy and Hollande in France. And, you know, that's not what's going on there with the euro crisis. The eurozone has a real banking problem. It's a structural problem. And they don't have the kind of central banking system that can deal with this crisis very well. And you get some of that in the coverage coming out of Europe as they run into these momentary crises from time to time. But more often you get the kind of the he said, she said, France against Germany, Germany against Greece. That's not very well informed reporting. That the stories on their face are not all that inaccurate, but it really doesn't help the reader to understand what's going on. And I think journalists, if they could dug more deeply in there and know how to use that information more fully, could do more accurate reporting in that instance and in other instances that are similar in nature.
Well, how much is reasonable to expect in real time? I think about, you know, on this show, which has been around for 6 or 7 years, we have probably done 20 programs on the things that that led up to and caused the United States Civil War. And people are still arguing over interpretation of knowledge today, even as we have gathered more and more information over the decades.
No, and that's right. I mean, I think reality in some areas is contestable, and you know, and we do fight over reality, and a lot of the disputes that seem to, you know, kind of be in areas where the facts seem shaky is because, in fact, the facts are shaky. And I think we need to have those kinds of discussions and disputes. But there are other areas where the facts are pretty clear, but they don't come out very fully. We had Nina Easton here a year ago as one of our fellows. She's from Fortune magazine, and she was really interested in the 1%, this income divide, and wanted to look at kind of the news coverage of the income divide. And so she picked a 20-year time period, and what she found is it was almost never covered. There was almost no stories at all in the press about the income divide. And then you come to October 2011, and suddenly it's a news story. Of course, this is when Occupy Wall Street sets up camp across from the New York Stock Exchange in New York. That alerted a journalist to this particular issue, but you know, it was out there. People were writing about it. This this income divide, the widening of that began in the 1980s. So this was not a surprise to people who'd been looking at that issue. But it was almost like as if journalists suddenly discovered that it's out there. And I think if journalists would try to see the world more broadly, and that is a question of knowing the world in a broader sense, I think we'd get a somewhat different kind of reporting. We'd get more perspective. We'd get more context. And it's perspective and context that ultimately kind of inform our judgment as citizens. These kind of the facts of day-to-day events, they keep us abreast of what's happening, but they really don't inform our judgment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chet in Corsicana. Hi, Chet.
Yeah, hi. It's actually Chip.
Oh, Chip. Hi. I'm sorry.
That's okay. As we turn into this soundbite society where everything is little snippets, how much freedom do the journalists have given to them by the editorial or the administrative staff of their papers or their agencies to actually become an informed journalist? If everybody's just going for the soundbite or the headline or whatever, how do these guys actually have the freedom and the time to be able to become an informed journalist, or are they just looking for the next bite?
Well, I that's a good question, Chip, and I think it is a problem for journalists. And increasingly, we do find ourselves into soundbite news. One reason, and as you imply, is that it's pretty safe for the journalists to engage in that kind of coverage. You know, someone once said that journalists are always safe if they report what someone said. They're less safe when they begin to talk about or to challenge what someone said. And so there's safety in that kind of reporting. This is also an area where I think knowledge comes into play. If you're a journalist covering those debates and you don't understand the debate very well, then it's very difficult for you to kind of enter the conversation and try to clarify what's at issue. I think we're seeing a lot of that around the budget shutdown, for example. You know, a lot of the sound bites have been on the Republican side is that the White House won't negotiate. On the Democratic side, that the Republicans are trying to take the government hostage. Well, there's a much deeper basis to what's going on in Washington right now. There are very substantial differences between Democrats and Republicans about what they would like government to be doing, what they think the proper balance of programs is, tax revenues, all of that. There's a really deeper reality here. I think journalists have to engage the debate at that level. And if they engage it at that level, then they can kind of insert correctives into these sound bites that we're hearing. On the other hand, if you just take it off the top, if you do sound bite journalism, then what you're going to do is you're going to simply put the controversy out there and basically tell the audience, now you decide where the truth lies. And what happens in that instance, and we've got a lot of research on that particular point, if you're a Democrat, you like what the Democrats are saying, believe that's true. If you're a Republican, you like what the Republicans are saying, believe that's true. And then we get into different worlds of reality. And once Republicans think reality is X and Democrats think reality is Y, then you have almost no hope of bridging the divide. You can't start a debate. You can't have a discussion when people don't agree on the facts.
There's also this reality that we tend to place a great value on balance within stories, which sounds on the face of it eminently reasonable. But there are cases in which the mandate to tell two sides of a particular story provides gravitas to what ultimately is really a fringe view.
No, that's right, Chris. And, you know, James Fellows from The Atlantic describes that as journalism of false equivalencies, that, you know, if you simply take at face value what newsmakers are saying, then you're going to put side by side, and he said journalism, truths, half-truths, and sometimes outright lies. And, you know, and oftentimes, you know, one side is closer to the facts than the other. But if you're not going to help the audience to sort that out, then in some ways you're just simply letting the newsmakers define. And they're going to define reality in the way that's convenient to them. So that, you know, I think journalism has an obligation to help us, because we don't have the facts, we don't have the information, to kind of understand what's really at issue here when people are being fairly honest and straightforward with us about the facts and about what they're planning to do. And if they sort of abrogate that responsibility, then we're left adrift. And I think we're impoverished as a result.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Eric in Mesquite. Hello, Eric.
Hello. I just wanted to ask your guest what he thinks about the Haster rule, and based upon that, why he thinks the media isn't really covering it as much as, well, some people think they should.
The Haster rule, you mean where the House will not vote on anything that does not have majority support within the ruling party?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the Haster rule is an informal rule. It's not a binding rule in the House of Representatives. But, you know, it originated in part around this growing strength of the parties in the sense that party leaders, including the Speaker, ought to be representatives of party sentiment. And you know, Boehner is pretty much abided by the Haster rule. Now, if he were to say, forget it for the moment and put some of these things that have come out of the Senate on the floor of the House, there would be a House majority for some of those Senate bills. You'd get nearly all the Democrats and you get enough Republicans to have a majority in the House. The problem with that for Boehner is that if he starts to do that, he's not going to be Speaker very long. And so the Haster rule gives Boehner cover. It allows him essentially to avoid putting himself in a position of putting legislation on the floor of the House that's going to be rejected by a majority of his caucus, but enacted through or passed through action on the part of the Democrats and some in his caucus. I think it's one of the rules in Congress. I think the filibuster, too. I think we've got in the Congress, we've got rules in Congress that allow sometimes fairly small minorities to gum up the entire works of Congress. And, you know, I think these are things that we need to revisit. The problem of revisiting them in the middle of this kind of controversy, the kind of conflict that's going on right now in the Congress, is that you can't do it. You need to do this when you have a little more space to maneuver. But I think both the Haster rule and the filibuster need rethinking.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Sam, who describes himself as a recovering journalist in Fort Worth. Sam writes, I've worked as a reporter for two big city daily newspapers at which dedicated, well-educated reports were hobbled by the proprietors' refusal to spend enough money to give reporters time and resources to do good work. Have you worked in such conditions?
Well, Sam has a good point, and it's, you know, the problem, as he describes, is getting worse. We have about, it depends on how you define a journalist, but if you define journalists as those who work in kind of the mainstream news organizations, you know, there are about a third fewer journalists than there were a decade ago as a result of declining circulations, declining ratings, and the advertising revenues that attend those numbers. So journalists are trying to do as much as they did in the past with fewer resources. And I think that is one of the reasons I think that more and more our journalism is somewhat inaccurate in its particulars. But to some degree, I think this is a false choice. I think the journalists today have no choice but to kind of keep up. I mean, we're in an age where we expect our news on demand and the constant updates and the like. And those can be small facts that kind of keep us abreast in the same way that, you know, we might tap into a baseball game or a football game and try to get an update, not just the score, but find out kind of what the dynamics of what's happening. But there's also a place in today's journalism for those deeper pieces. And what we're finding on the web, and it's kind of interesting, is that the pieces that tend to get moved around the most, that actually get sent from one person to another, tend to be those deeper, more informative pieces. So I think that aspect of journalism is out there, and it gets its own reward in the marketplace, but we have too little of it. And we have too little of it in part because we don't have enough resources for journalists, but I think also that many in editorial positions don't understand the real value of that kind of journalism. And they're all struggling now to kind of figure out how to monetize stories. But, You know, the stories that are evergreen, those that are around for several months, they have a value not only in terms of informing us about what's going on out there, but they have value in terms of enhancing the brand of news organizations. And in the long term, I think what's going to make journalism successful in the marketplace is if you have a brand and people trust it and they know if they go there, they're going to get good information.
So I would agree with you, Thomas, that there is still a demand for quality journalism. There are still people providing it. There is also, in addition to that, though, and particularly online, a lot of this stuff that is sort of passed off as journalism but is really just an amalgamation of other people's original reporting into something that may feel new but may not constitute anything other than checking other online sources and sticking them all in the same story.
Oh, I agree with that. And that, of course, it when misinformation gets into the mix, you know, then you get a multiplier for misinformation as well. I mean, during the 2009-2010 healthcare reform debate, it was only a couple of months into that debate before we got this death panels allegation, this notion that there would be commissions that would decide whether the elderly would be entitled to additional healthcare benefits and healthcare generally. And you know, that started to circulate in talk shows first, and then it got on the web, and then it even worked its way into the mainstream press. And by the time it was over, about half the American public at peak thought that, in fact, the proposed legislation had death panels, had a death panels provision, whereas, in fact, it did not. So, you know, I think there is a place for mischief there. I think there's a place for misinformation there. But to me, that's an argument for why we need really good journalism. One of the things that's happened in the media system is we've got a lot more outlets now for public information. Not only the traditional press, the talk shows, the blogs, and the so on, and so forth. Where are we going to go to really get reliable, trustworthy information? That has to come from journalists.
My guest is Thomas E. Patterson. He is Bradley Professor of Government and the Press at the Harvard Kennedy School. His new book is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Thomas E. Patterson of the Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard. His new book is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that is where we find Tim on the line in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey there. Great program, as always. You know, I'm 45, and so I've been around long enough to see, you know, quite a few changes in my lifetime in terms of the way that that journalism works. It seems that I remember that, you know, not too long ago, straightforward, non-opinionated journalism was the norm, and punditry was definitely on the sidelines and was seen, depending on who you spoke to, as more of a means of entertainment or a way to just kind of hear someone's opinion. Anymore, it almost seems like everything has switched in the exact 180-degree opposite direction. Punditry is now the norm and accepted as what is considered quote-unquote journalism and quote-unquote the news, whereas, you know, really non-opinionated, objective news is on the periphery and doesn't seem to be taken as seriously by a whole lot of people. And, you know, a perfect example of how that stuff is working now is I watch a lot of the different news channels, and so, for example, Fox News got, you know, for lack of a better word, punk last week whenever somebody sent in a story that President Obama was using his own money in order to keep some mosques open in the midst of the government shutdown. Now, it came out not too long after that that, of course, that was a false story, and they had been, you know, they had been fooled by that. But rather than them coming back on the air and saying, hey, listen, we messed up, and this is what actually is the deal, it was a one-sentence Twitter feed that went out that said, you know, essentially that same apology, which in my mind was you know, pretty spineless, but I'm, you know, that's my opinion on that as well. So just your thoughts on those two issues and ideas.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think Tim is on to something. My sense is that he's right, that increasingly our journalism is aimed for controversy rather than for information, that there's a lot more punditry, I think particularly on cable. A lot of this is carried through that he said, she said kind of journalism, which really is journalism that pumps up the conflict, pumps up the controversy, and then gets into these kind of endless disputes that seem to go nowhere. Part of that also, I think, is that, and there's some pretty good evidence on this, the news has become increasingly Washington-centric, what goes on in the Beltway is more and more kind of what the news is all about. A lot of that has to do with cable and the fact that their programs originate in Washington. It's pretty easy to get people in Washington to come on the program. That's cheap journalism. It doesn't cost very much money compared to news gathering, the kind of going out, covering the story, bringing back the story, putting it together, the kinds of things that inform us. It's also easy journalism. It's very easy for journalists to do he said, she said reporting. It's really easy to do the kind of game reporting, political game reporting that goes on in Washington, who's up, who's down, is Obama winning this shutdown war, are the House Republicans winning it? That's really easy to do. And in terms of the kind of news coverage that would really inform us, I do think that has been diminished. Walter Pincus from the Washington Post said recently that, food is a very important issue to the American people, but the only time that we seem to get stories about it is when there's an outbreak of food poisoning. And I think there's been this general tendency to go toward the less expensive, more controversial, conflict-ridden, he said, she said kind of journalism, in part because it's easy, in part because it's cheap. But that means a lot has been left off the table about issues that we really need to know about.
And you write about the fact, in terms of sort of grabbing for the low-hanging fruit, we hear a great deal more about the political infighting and one-upsmanship than we hear about the influence of, say, lobbying groups, not because they are any less influential in politics, but because what they do often happens behind closed doors.
Well, and the point behind that particular example in the book was to say that, journalism traditionally has overplayed those things that are most visible. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of coverage of elections because that's visible, that's easy to cover. Lobbying is a lot tougher to cover. And I think this is where kind of knowledge comes into play. People who are deeply schooled in the political process understand that a lot of the key policy decisions are not made on the campaign trail. There are always a few major issues that get played out on the campaign trail, but there are scores of other issues that work themselves out through the lobbying system, the pressure that interest groups place on lawmakers. And, that tends to be undercovered substantially, but it's really difficult to cover that particular part of American politics unless you're well informed about it. And certainly there are some Washington journalists who can do that and do that well. But most of them cannot do it very well, and so they go toward the easier, the low-hanging fruit, the kind of the conflict that's right in front of your face at the moment.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Emily on the line now in Coppell. Hi, Emily.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Love your show.
Thank you.
Haven't heard the entire program, so I don't know for sure that this question has not been asked, but I would like to know how important is the role of the fact-checking organizations, and how accurate are they?
Well, Emily, that's a good question, and I think you would get different answers to that from different people. Certainly my friend and colleague at the University of Pennsylvania, Kathleen Hall Jamison, who's done a lot of work in this area and was one of the pioneers in trying to advance fact-checking, would argue that it's very important. My view on it is a little bit different. My sense is that the fact checkers go overboard, they kind of take issue with almost anything that's even a little off center. In politics, exaggeration is has been part of politics since the beginning of politics. It'll always be out there. Nikita Khrushchev said that politicians are always going to promise you a bridge over a river that doesn't exist. So, you know, that's just that. So, to me, if you start fact checking even the small little things, the small exaggerations, then you begin to really kind of cloud the water. That what we really ought to be paying attention to are the big fibs around big issues. That's where our attention ought to be directed. The problem is the incentive for a fact-checking organization is to, the more kind of facts or misplaced facts that they can put up, the better they feel. And then, of course, others join in and say, well, that's not really, and so on. So you start to get a back and forth between the fact-checkers and the anti-fact-checkers. I think they have an important role to play, particularly since news organizations have cut back on their resources for internal fact-checking. I do think there's an important role for fact-checkers in our media system. But like everything else, it needs to be exercised with judgment. And I would say the same thing about, we were talking earlier about the coverage of Washington. We need the coverage of Washington. We need some of the political game. When they're out on the election, in the election cycle, we need some polls that tell us who's up and down. But if these become the story, if these really essentially drive the way that we think about elections or what's going on in Washington, then we're kind of missing what's really critical about our politics. And that's the issues and leadership questions that we face as a people. And if we don't concentrate more fully on those, if we don't understand those very well, then we're kind of adrift as a public. And you can see that increasingly. We've seen rising levels of misinformation on the part of the public. I cited the death panels earlier. We've got half the public that either denies global warming or, if they accept it, say that it's due to natural causes like sunspots and tilts of the earth. We have lots of good evidence to suggest it's going on and that this is something that we need to pay attention to. In the lead-up to the Iraq war, when more than half the public thought that Iraq's Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda's Osama bin Laden were aligned in a war against the United States. These two individuals were enemies. They weren't allies, and yet we thought they were connected. Those of us who actually had that opinion were more likely to support the invasion of Iraq. So I do think as a public, we need better information. We need to pay closer attention, because it affects our judgment about what government ought to be doing.
Can you talk about what scholars discovered when they went to study the processes reporters themselves use to verify information that they want to include in their stories?
Well, the process of verification, I think, is a really is a difficult one for journalists. I mean, I'm not trying to minimize the task that journalists face. Oftentimes, an issue will come out of nowhere, and they've got to report on it almost immediately. And the way the journalists traditionally try to get on top of issues is to talk to some of the people who are involved or experts who might know something about it. If it's close by and they can observe it, go observe some of the scene. But there are limits to these. Interviews are very handy, and you can gather a lot of information quickly, but you're vulnerable to the interviewee. What they know, what they think they know, and in some cases, their attempt to really kind of deceive you about the facts. And of course, observation also has its limits. You're limited to what you can see, and oftentimes the event that you're trying to cover has already happened, and so you're kind of left with the remnants of the scene of the event. So there's some real limits on this, and that's where knowledge can really kind of help you inform your judgments in these particular instances. Have situations of this type occurred before? What's been the pattern? What's been the tendency there? That's not only helpful in trying to think about how to tell the story, but it's also important in trying to contextualize the story, because it's really from the context what we're told about what the meaning of this. So this goes back to the question of journalists as our sense makers. What's the meaning of this development? That's context. And the more the journalist knows about those kinds of situations, the more accurate the context is going to be, and therefore more likely we are to draw appropriate inferences from what we read here or see in the news.
Let's go back to the phone one last time. We have Jake on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Chris. Love the show. And Dr. Patterson, thank you so much for the work you're doing. I just had a quick question. I really wanted to know what more we can do as citizens to try and promote this kind of really in-depth investigative reporting that's, you know, more informative and less focused on punditry or, you know, flamboyant opinion, you know, other than, say, you know, the typical, like, subscribing to informative newspapers or clicking on articles that actually are informative as opposed to fluff. And I'll take my question off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think Jake asks one of the toughest questions that journalists or the news industry faces, and that's basically how to get the support that's needed for really good journalism. I do think that it really is dependent on us to support good journalism, just as it is dependent on us as voters to support good candidates and to punish those that perform badly. And there are a lot of candidates today that in their televised political advertising think the truth is whatever you want it to be. And sometimes they get away with it, and we let it pass. And I think the same thing happens with many news organizations. I mean, we've seen over the last 20 years or so the rise of infotainment. You know, the degree to which some news outlets pump up celebrity and crime and sensationalism, and it's all designed to lure us in. We ought to resist some of that. We ought to say we're not going to join that particular audience and reward those that do a good job of news. But, you know, this is a long-term process because news tastes are developed. We acquire them. And it's through good journalism that we come to understand what good journalism is all about and why it's important to have it. So it's in some ways it's a circle. The better the journalism, the more we're going to appreciate it, the more we're going to have a taste for it. It'll feed back in. It'll increase the demand for good journalism. So I think what Jake has pointed at is, in the long term, probably the most important question about what journalism in the future is going to look like.
We just have a few seconds left, but in terms of transparency in the news gathering process, why is that so valuable?
Well, I think what makes it important, Chris, is that if you have transparency, it's like transparency in elections. It's like transparency in government. To the degree that you can see what's going on, what's in and what's out in terms of, let's say, a news story, what journalists have or haven't done in trying to track that story down to tell it fully, the more we kind of understand what a process entails, the participants in that process, if they know that they can be tracked, if what they did can be discovered, they're going to do a better job of it.
The new book by Thomas E. Patterson is called Informing the News, The Need for Knowledge-Based Journalism. Thomas, thank you so much for making time for us this hour.
Oh, Chris, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help today from Christina Martinez on the phones. Christine McConnell prepares our podcast, and Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org or Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Once again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.